Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program photographer Lucian Niemeyer. He has a new book. It's called The Art of Flower Photography, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So flowers, they're beautiful. Does that make them easy to photograph?
No, when something is very beautiful, photography is not easy because one has to go beyond the beauty and catch the essence of the object. So the difficulty always is to put yourself in a neutral position and catch the flower in its beauty. That means whether you catch it with color, that means how you handle the light, how you handle all aspects of it. And hopefully, if you've composed it well and you've chosen light well and the colors are correct, then you have a good picture. So it's not as easy as it first looks. But most professional artists, most good artists of photography cut their teeth on flower photography.
Is that right?
Yes.
Interesting. You say in the book that you use only natural light, and I noticed that a lot of the pictures have dark, almost black backgrounds. How do you achieve that?
That is done because I can remember one sunflower you saw. That was an outdoor shot of in West Virginia. And the flower was so bright and the background was not real dark. But what happened is when the adjustment was made for the quality, for the amount of light going to it, the background became black.
And so that's what you then achieve. I mean, you're not using artificial constructs and backgrounds and so on. You're photographing in nature with natural light just as is.
That's correct. I never constructed a picture. I use the composition that's there. I will use a framing. In other words, I will draw the picture closer or further away via my lens, but I don't do more than that.
So is this book intended for photographers?
It was interesting. There was a review, Midwest Book Review, that just did a review on it, and they cited the fact that the images were so beautiful. And then they said that that I drew the art of flower photography very, very simply and correctly so that almost anybody could understand it. When I first conceived this book, everybody told me that I should do. I had many exhibits and many flowers, and everybody said, you should do a book. The problem of it was, what do I tell in the text of a flower book? I can talk about the individual flower. There's many scientific books that do that much better than I could ever do it. Subsequently, I did something I've never done before, and that is talk about how I shoot, how I create the flower photography that I've done.
Why have you never done that before?
I don't know. I guess that I'm kind of laid back. I just don't really talk about the craft that I work at so hard very often. I get out of myself into the objects more, like the Africa books or the wetland books or the New Mexico book, for instance. I try to tell that story and catch the essence of it. So I really never very much talk about my craft except to explain to people that I use natural light and that I do not use artificiality. In other words, I don't use saturated films or things like that. I use very neutral films.
Are the details of a photographer's craft like trade secrets? Or do you kind of share that stuff with each other as a general rule?
Photography has been it's a very important art and a very important craft. The problem is that we get stereotyped into how to photograph very easily. For instance, if you go to Bosque de la Patch, the people that have the most admiration have the longest lens with big equipment all around them, and they shoot. Quite often, that equipment is just not necessary. And I go into that in this particular book. I knock some stereotype walls down on photography. I think it has changed immensely. Then I go and I find out very recently that many of the really good photographers are using the same equipment I have, a $300 camera instead of a $1,500 or $2,000. I used to spend up to $3,600 for a lens. I'd spend $3,000 for a body. These were using film. And when I Leica came out with a new digital camera, I called up the president of Leica, who's a friend of mine, and I said, would you loan me that $10,000 piece of equipment while I go to Bali? He said, sure, I'd loan it to you, Lucian. Next day, I saw an ad for an $895 digital camera by Leica. And I said, there's a digit wrong here. And I said, I'm going to order one to my wife. And I ordered it, and I got it. I was amazed. What happened was Leica is known for its lenses. And it's very important because they use rare earth lenses, which allow the color red to come correctly on the film plane. I tried this particular camera, and I was amazed. The electronics were by Panasonic, which had a big, long history of doing very, very good electronics for TV cameras and things. The natural joining of forces between Leica and Panasonic created a whole new wave of cameras, which is quite extraordinary.
And very relatively inexpensive, so that what might have been prohibitive to a mid- or lowish income photographer was now suddenly available.
Precisely. When I would go to Africa, I would carry 50 pounds of equipment. I'd carry 40 rolls of film. I'd carry two bodies, three lenses. I keep the weight down, but even then, it was very, very heavy. It became too much. My new equipment, I can get two bodies. I can get some batteries. I can get some two chips. My weight is like 5 pounds, and my ability is better.
Amazing.
It's truly amazing. The thing that happened was when Leica came and Panasonic came out with this camera, it gave you a range of 35 to 420 millimeters, which is 90% of anybody shooting. If you want to shoot nature at 420, you can. When they came out, it broke the mold. Immediately after that, Nikon, Canon, Olympus all came out with cameras not too different. Panasonic came out, Leica and Panasonic broke up a little bit, and Panasonic came out with a new camera, which is the one I'm showing you, which is very small, and as you can feel, very light.
I'm holding the Panasonic Lumix FZ35. Yes, it's very light indeed.
Look at the lens. Leica lens.
Yep.
So in this little camera, I have exactly the same thing. I have the ability to shoot with the best lens you can get, and I have a very light camera. This camera here goes up to 27 to 470, which gives me an enormous range, and it gives me the ability to shoot fast and correctly. This has changed the world. Right now, you can buy this in New York at one of the places for $250.
Right.
It's incredible. So what has happened now is my book is going to create some difficulty because I talk about this change, this new thinking and philosophy. But I didn't realize that pros were already using this. Alfred, who was just here, is using just this camera. Many other pros that I'm finding out have found it too, the same way. We don't have to buy all the expensive equipment. The technology that's been produced over 20 years is bound in this camera, and it's become so expertise that you really don't have to go into $1,500, $2,000 cameras with separate lenses.
Why do you say it's going to cause problems that you've put this in your book?
Because it's going to cause the camera manufacturers and the camera sellers that are selling these big elaborate pieces of equipment not to buy them. The manufacturers have a hard time. If you go to some of the trading houses in Europe, they don't know how to place this camera. They don't know. It's not a compact. It's not a. It's not a SLR. It acts like an SLR in many ways, but they don't know where to place it. And in fact, this exceeds almost everything out there.
We're talking to Lucian Niemeyer. Now, the transition from film to digital was something, and we've seen the exact same thing in motion pictures as well. There was a moment where the digital image, although it wasn't identical to the film image, became as sharp, as beautiful, as compelling. And that took many years, but they got there.
Huge amount of years. The software that is used in most cameras today are very, very similar. That is both in terms of reading, in other words, the light meter, the technology and the curves, the logarithms are very, very similar. So that was thought out and worked out many years ago. And we heard, as you know, most people that have these little small cameras like the one you have here, the little Panasonic.
I happen to also have a little Panasonic Lumix, but it's tiny. It fits in the palm of your hand and was less expensive, but it also has a Leica lens.
Yes. And what happens is on this is people said, why should I have this big equipment when this works so well? And that did revolutionize it quietly, very quietly. The pros said, oh, no, you can't with a big equipment. You have to have big equipment to make it work. Well, the problem always was with that is that you had the difficulty of changing lenses all the time, and quite often it wasn't opportunity to do that. So the people that shot with these big SLRs with many lenses really had to work efficiently and effectively to get their picture. Something else happened. When Panasonic came out with those TV cameras that were used, the big ones, they saw that they had a real problem with camera shake. And they worked on the technology to reduce that camera shake very strongly. Today, this camera that I have here, the one I showed to you, I can take it out, shoot it 480 handheld, and I will come over 1,000 yards and I'll have a clear image. Now, that's revolutionary in photography.
480, I mean, that is a way, way, way zoomed in shot.
That is correct. So when I can do that, all of a sudden I've said, wow, now all of a sudden I don't have to have the tripod which keeps me tethered to something. Now I can shoot fluidly. I do use fences, I use posts, I use many things to quiet the camera shake. But
and a mount to your body too, a shoulder mount.
I use a shoulder mount, yes, which does. But the ability to take good pictures and blow it up to 32 by 19 or 21 is very, very competent in this little camera at $300. I mean, it's just $250. It's an amazing change. So it's changed things. Still, people are the big camera manufacturers are selling the big SLRs and marketing them. But the true fact is that this brand of cameras, which all the camera makers jumped on, is the future.
We're talking to Lucian Niemeyer. His new book is called The Art of Flower Photography. Now, you said a moment ago that you were kind of breaking some of the stereotypes about photography. What are some of the other stereotypes that are going by the wayside?
Well, the stereotype that you have to have a tripod to shoot nature photography.
Okay.
When you're out in the field, flexibility of how you work, the lightness of how much equipment you have with you, creates the ability to take many pictures that are competent. When I'm out in the field and I'm looking at it, following a bird, I don't have much time. The thing that's happened in these new cameras is that I'm not tethered to a tripod or to a shoulder mount. The second factor is that the speed of taking that picture with the newer digital cameras is very, very good, which means that the capture rate is very, very good. So quietly over years, without much fanfare, photography has been changed. Photography has been technically improved incredibly. The ability to shoot, compose with your lens from the closest distance to the furthest distance is very, very fine. Yes, there are some cases like sport photography with very high speeds where this would probably not be as good. You needed to use some film and some other equipment.
Is that right? There are still things where film is better?
Yes, there are. Film is a very, very good mechanism. The biggest problem is what took me away from film was the fact that I lost my neutral films. When I mean neutral films, I'm talking about that are color balanced very normally, which means that when I then take it to a printer, I can blow it up normally because all the logarithms of that printer are based on neutral film. So it became very, very important to have a neutral film for me.
Now, neutral film, you mean the colors are neither warm nor cool?
That's correct. And that means or exaggerated. For instance, like Velvia was exaggerated, the ektachromes were exaggerated. So what it always took then, when you did printing, you had to tone it down somehow, you had to change it. And they had different formulas for doing that. I chose to have a very neutral films. That was Agfa 100. It was Kodachrome 200. It was Provia was good, but even those took a little bit of manipulation. I had to have a little bit of a formula when I printed.
Now, are any of the cameras that you use able to take the old lenses from the days of film?
No, I took $20,000 or $25,000 worth of Leica equipment, packed it up very carefully, and put it in a box, and I don't use them anymore. It's outdated.
So I was wondering if they made digital bodies that took the old lenses.
They have digital bodies, and they do use the old, they can use the old lenses, but they're outdated too.
Yeah.
The reason is that to change them doesn't make sense when I'm sitting here with all the changes necessary in one very short light lens.
Right.
Doesn't make sense.
So let's go back to talking about flowers themselves. It's interesting to observe, I think, what people bring to flowers, because like any art form, so much of the photographer is in the image, and there are people who, when they take flower pictures, they look very feminine, and you have that kind of a effect of, I mean, not to go into too much, but, you know, femininity. And then I remember Robert Mapplethorpe could make any flower look phallic, you know. And when I look at your photographs, I see this love of color and form and of the close-up, of really looking carefully.
Yes, that's very interesting, Eric. What it is Mapplethorpe creates sensuality. He had a lot of sex in his images, whether it be of people or of flowers or of any objects. It became very important. But it was his imposition onto the object. So you didn't get a real, actual, clear look at the object. You got his interpretation.
But isn't that true of everybody?
No. I think that... I guess I have to qualify that. Yes, when you manipulate the zoom lens, and you look at the images and you determine that you don't want to have a telephone pole or something like that. Yes, you do manipulate that portion. But my intent in all of these, it was to bring out the essence of the flower, not to put my imposition on it. And I think that is the way I shoot. You have to remember that while all this new technology is coming on, the craft of photography is the same. It is light. It is the interpretation of light. It is the interpretation of light on color, which determines what kind of an image you're going to have. So in that respect, it hasn't changed at all. The composition hasn't changed. These are things that are in the photographer's mind that creates the art that he has or the craft that he has. They haven't changed. Light is the single most important factor of any photography.
Now, you talk about light, and there was some terminology that you used that I'd never heard before. You talked about positive and negative light. What does that mean?
Yesterday and the day before, here in Santa Fe, when it was overcast, there was negative light. It is a feeling you get about it. When you have an overcast day that just doesn't pleasant to you, it is a negative light. The great photographer Elliot Porter knew how to get positive light at the same time overcast, very, very overcast.
I mean, positive and negatives, those are emotional qualities that you're, is that what you mean?
Precisely.
Okay.
And so there is a cross, and I can't tell you exactly what light it is. I can tell you what the feeling is. And when you have a positive overcast day that is beautiful, the pictures can be very beautiful, can be very detailed, very, very beautiful, very very much contrast. When you have a negative, you come away from that picture feeling that you don't want to look at it anymore. It's a negative feeling. And it is. It's an emotional feeling that you have. There's another thing that's very important. The interpretation of white light. White light in the East is usually the humidity rate percentage that you have. For instance, if you have a 60% or 70% humidity, that would mean that's high white light, which means that the image, the light is being refracted back to you, which means that the detail in the images taken is very good.
And now you say in the East, so you're talking about morning light only?
You're talking morning light is cool light. Afternoon light is warm light. That's because the sun has been down on it and it's warmed up the earth. But the and here we have the same thing, only quite often it can be dust. You have still how much, what percentage of white light do you have? If you have a 20% of white light, then you start to see strong contrast. You see lines, forms, you see brilliant colors. You see, if you try to shoot faces, they're not going to come out right. If you have an overcast light, you're going to get your faces, you're going to get the detail in the fence, the stone wall, all of that. And that becomes, these qualities of evaluating that light become the single most important portion of photography.
Now, back in the old days, I studied black and white photography many years ago, and they had there were tricks you could do. You could, depending on whether it was a very bright sunny day or whether it was an overcast day, you could underexpose and overdevelop or vice versa and compensate for the light. Can you do similar things in digital photography?
Yes, but not as much. It is not as prevalent in color photography to do. You can do it in digital, sure. Digital has no difference in black and white. Black and white then becomes is more manipulatable than color photography.
Yeah, that's true.
So in color, yes, you have some room. You can add the contrast. In other words, depending upon what the cameras do, for instance, the two Leica, this Panasonic and the other Leica camera I have, put a higher degree of magenta. So I always have to add a little green, and I usually crank up the contrast one notch. And
how do you add green?
You just, in Photoshop, you have the ability to add seven points of green. And then I always do one on contrast. I crank it up one notch, and on the case of sharpness, I always do an sharp focus. So these are small things. They're just little changes, very subtle, but they help the image.
We're talking to Lucian Niemeyer. When you're looking through the camera, is there a gap between what you see and what then comes out as the picture?
Not if you know your camera and you know what you're shooting. I know when I'm out there shooting. There are times when you don't read the light right. Unusual. It could be in the morning, could be in the evening late. It's hard to say. But most of the time, I know exactly what I've got. Because where you position the light coming to you so it's reflective off of the object, these are all important issues. But the quality of light and how you interpret it is the most important. Mary Catherine, could you tell which ones in this book were digital and weren't?
No, but I wasn't looking at it with that in mind.
It's interesting because I think you will not be able to see much difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the new technology has created. Sure, there's a little depth of field difference. There's a few differences that you can notice. But for the most part, the quality of digital photography is very, very good today.
So when you are teaching people, when you are doing almost a kind of didactic thing of how you use the time of day and the sky conditions and the humidity and so on, I mean, where does a young photographer who's learning this thing, this kind of stuff, where do they start? Does everybody have to recreate it for themselves through trial and error?
I think so. I think that the way I taught my wife on this is I said, I want you to tell me today, what is the white light today? Tell me what the percentage is and tell me what you would shoot today. You can't make light, so you have to shoot with the light you have. So it'll determine the kind of picture you want to take. And that becomes very important. So after you've determined that you've got a 69% white light, then you might want to shoot faces. You might want to shoot walls. You might want to shoot something that has very great detail. And that's what's determinant. If you then try to do broad patterns, broad things on an overcast day, it's not going to look as good as it would when you had a little bit brighter day. Elliot Porter was the master. Elliot Porter was probably the greatest photographer that, first of all, this country ever had, but probably in the world. And the way he used white light, overcast light, and the way he used colors at a time when film was very, very new and very difficult to handle was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant.
when you say, okay, on an overcast day you can get good faces and details, and on a bright day you can get much more vivid colors. So for flowers, what are some of the best shooting conditions for you when you take pictures of flowers?
My favorite condition for light is overcast, because I then can control the pictures much better, depending how bright it is and how bright it's not. But I prefer an overcast day all the time. When I shoot, there's only so many images you can do in a very low white light day that and they'll all stand out. They're all lovely forms and bright colors, but there's how many can you do that really tell a story?
And yet your photographs, the colors are so bright.
They're bright, and that's because they're natural, and I've chosen it because flowers, you want that. Of all the characteristics of flower, one is form, the other one is color, and you want to show it in its. But there's some very subtle colors too. Do you remember the roses that I took? The ones with the bead of water and the little. Those are very, very gentle, very, very beautiful. They're not that brilliant. Then there's others that are brilliant, but again, in all of the pictures, I'm trying to catch the essence of that particular flower.
Now the book is called The Art of Flower Photography. It's also a little bit of a lesson in botany, because for every flower you include its species, which I was thinking, if I were in your shoes, just finding out what they were all called, that's a job in itself.
Well, that's part of the background of the book, of the research you do for the book.
Yeah. Does knowing the classification, does that change the way you think about flowers at all, or is it more just for us so that we know what they're called?
That is precisely correct. I had the Latin for each one of these, too. I decided to leave it out because it really wasn't material.
Now, do you do flower photography while you're pursuing other projects? Do you set out specifically with flower photography in mind? I noticed that you've got a book that's going to be coming out on Bali. There are some Balinese flowers in it that I thought were so beautiful. Do those just happen kind of along the way while you're doing other projects?
Certainly. Whenever you're doing a project, you might want to do opportunistic shooting. And in Bali, how could you not do pictures of flowers in Bali? I mean, it's a flower country, and the smell is always there. So, yes, whenever you're doing a study, you're going to pick up other things opportunistically. And in the case of the Bali book, which is completed, yes, I did a lot of flower photography, some of which is in this book.
We're talking to Lucian Niemeyer, and there's another book by the same publisher, Schiffer, as the flower book. It's called West Virginia Mountain Air. What's the book about? How did you decide to do a book on the state of West Virginia?
I had done a book on the Shenandoah Valley, which was, it told the story of the very, very, the revolutionary history of this country. And it was very important. My wife and I went to West Virginia and at that time and found it to be so beautiful. Then we started to dig into the history of what had gone on in West Virginia. We said, we have to tell this story. It is so poignant, so beautiful, so important for America that they need to know it.
What was the tip-off that led you down that path?
The fact that the state was so backward in terms of economics and yet was so very, very, very beautiful. It was so different from what I had seen before, the bare mountains with children running barefoot and with destitute. The stories, of course, of the wars between the Hatfields and McCoys and the John Henry and 16 tons and where you get the another day over and deeper in debt, the towns. Then you travel West Virginia and the story comes alive and it's huge.
Now, it's a state with tremendous natural resources, particularly in the form of coal, and the money that comes from that does not go to West Virginians.
It was interesting. After the Civil War, the black did not have a place to go to work. And the immigrants coming in from Europe didn't have a place to work. They had heard about the coal mines and the lumbering that was going on in West Virginia, and they came there in great numbers. And so first it was the railroads that were developed to go into all the small valleys and the small places to bring out the coal. And then later, after the coal was depleted and was mechanized more, then the forests were clear cut. So the whole of West Virginia, which had gorgeous forests, was totally clear cut.
When was that?
This was in the 1890s and 1920 era.
And what's amazing is that, I mean, we forget, we just had a conversation, I guess it was last week, about Aldo Leopold. How much destruction happened over 100 years ago in the late 19th century, that first burst of the Industrial Revolution and the incredible natural destruction that it caused?
Very much so. The interesting part is that the companies that built these, the railroads, and the companies that built the mines were all in the East. We're in the Baltimore area, we're in the Washington area, we're in New York. And they built the company towns that we're so knowledgeable about. But when the coal was depleted, or they went to mechanization, or there was a depletion of the gas and oil, the Rockefellers, for instance, they just left. There was no development of the infrastructure of West Virginia. So it was left alone, and the people had no place to go. Yes, some migrated to Ohio to the auto factories that were starting up. But for the most part, the people that didn't want to go had no subsistence ability.
Now, you write about in the book, I mean, it's a book certainly of photographs, but also this history of tremendous exploitations, strikes, and ultimately civil rights battles and labor battles that West Virginians had to fight.
Very much so. And it was a correct use, I think, my opinion, of the unions and developing togetherness so that there was a fair adjudication between unions and companies. But the exploitation was huge. I mean, when you think of a beautiful state, take Colorado and clear cut it and see how beautiful it is. So it was destroyed. But the people were wonderful. There was two types of people. There were the mountain people, which, of course, were the Hatfields and McCoys. And then there were the people that came into work in these different lumber camps and the coal mines. And when the companies pulled out, they just closed the company town. There was a church still there, so there was a huge, beautiful, the people went to church. That was their social place. But the rest of it wasn't there. There was no roads. There was no ability to have subsistence farming because the hills were up and down. You hear constantly about when there's floods, that West Virginia gets flooded very deeply, and that's because these are all deep valleys. They're old valleys, and they're very steep. So there's no ability to put corn down or to live. So then you saw the pictures of Appalachia, and that was the barefoot, very tattered dress of a child in a desolate forest or desolate land. And it was a picture that was looked on upon by horror by the American people. And they developed this term, Appalachia. It wasn't deserved, because they are the ones that built the wealth, that built the Industrial Revolution and turbocharged America to the forefront in terms of economic powers.
And are still doing so and are still being exploited. I mean, the clear-cutting, you go into a little bit in the book, that is happening now, the mountaintop mining is a disaster for that state.
It's a very serious problem. The companies try to say that they restore the land to what it was, but they can't do that in terms of when they do the slag, it goes into the streams, and they can't dig it all out and create the narrow ravines that allow the water to go out. So it's a continuing problem. It's a continuing difficulty of balances between the big companies and the environment.
And, you know, they say they're restoring the ecosystems, but they're entirely different ecosystems.
Totally. And that's the problem, of course. And that's what the people say. Whenever you do very, very great industrial things like mining, there are prices to pay. The key must be to put balances in so that things work correctly. And in the cases of this huge mining operation they're going in West Virginia, it is still desecrating the environment.
Now, there are all sorts of pictures in the book. There's pictures of wildlife, of people, of buildings. There's one building. Where is it? I'm looking at the book right now of a building that looks almost Asian, a kind of a...
That's a very interesting picture, a series of pictures. There was a movement by the of Eastern Indian cult which built a city, and it's absolutely beautiful with marble and with tile. The architecture's stunning, and it just sits there. It's enormous. It's enormous, but it is looked upon badly by the locals because it is such a strange religion.
Right, so the religion is not part of the local culture, and so it's kind of an outsider.
Yes, but it is a spectacular place to go, and it is it's done very, very well.
What was your own experience of traveling around West Virginia like? I mean, there you were showing up virtually everywhere in the state with a camera. What were your interactions with people like?
They were very good. The state of West Virginia is probably one of our most beautiful states. I would put it in the category of Utah, Wyoming, Colorado. New Mexico, of course. New Mexico, to me, is probably is the unsold beauty of the United States. But the and I don't mind keeping it that way either. The beauty of West Virginia tells a story, and it reveals it very clearly. Yes, there are towns in the South which are still very, very backward coal mining towns, very, very poor, very dirty, very grimy. And the funny part is when you see a $500,000 house next to a shack, and you know that the person got a settlement from the coal mines for the coal dust there. So it is a series of dichotomies if you look at it. But I found it to be earthy. I found it to be at the soul of this country, and I think that that's why I tell the story of the Shenandoah, of New Mexico, and of West Virginia and the Chesapeake, because and Maine, because I find these stories to be evocative of the soul that we live in this country.
You talked a moment ago about how West Virginia went through this period where it was virtually clear cut. That was for the timber companies?
That's correct.
And once it was clear cut, what happened then?
Well, the people had a choice. They could either go and leave this state, or they could stay there, but there was no place to make money. The people turned, many, many of the people turned to moonshine. The Prohibition came along. At the time that before this, when they turned to moonshine, they were still hospitable. You would go into West Virginia, any cabin was open, anybody that was poor, you'd get a meal, you'd get a place to stay overnight. When the Prohibition came in, the revenuers came in, and all of a sudden, after the revenuers had gone through the state and knocked down all the stills, all of a sudden, the populace was not friendly to anybody coming. They were suspicious of government. They were suspicious of our federal government. And they went into their own cloister, and that's where they are now. They go to church. They're very patriotic. They have wonderful families, and they celebrate as families, very close-knit families. But they don't trust the government. They don't trust the people.
It is a kind of funny combination to be very patriotic and very suspicious of government at the same time.
Yes, they... I can tell you a neat story. One of our friends, or one of my wife's friends, lives in West Virginia, and he said, I want to take you to a real interesting situation. He took us up with a four-wheel drive up this very narrow, rough road up to the top of the mountain, which is called Fried Meat Ridge. There lived a master fiddler. He played for 3 hours. He was incredible. He's 82 years old. He's now dead. He played whiskey before breakfast. When we had to go to the restroom, we went down to an outhouse, and there was a Sears catalog there to take care of. There's no water, no electricity. This was West Virginia. This is the West Virginia that I know and I know of. It is a very, very powerful image of people that lived together, of cared for each other, had their own music, and want to live pretty much alone.
What's the basis of the economy there at this point?
Very poor economy. The best part of West Virginia are the spectacular state parks, which have Olympic swimming pools. They're just incredible resorts, every one of them. That is one. They've attracted people that way. They've done water sports, the rafting, it's tourism is the biggest thing. But even then, it's very poor still. The infrastructure, they just don't have money for the infrastructure. Very difficult to do. Bird.
Even though there's all this coal.
Yeah. They're now getting the results of it. That was the difficult part. The politicians were in bed with the coal companies and the oil companies, and they never extracted the tax necessary like we have here in New Mexico for the raw materials taken out. Subsequently, there was no infrastructure. There was a pretty corrupt government. In fact, it is interesting to note that when I sent this the text to some politicians, that they didn't want the book to be done because I was critical of the politics that had caused the problem of the exploitation.
But it wasn't about them, it was about their predecessors.
Yes, that is correct, but they didn't want the onus of it on their state. New Mexico did it much better.
In what sense?
They exacted a tax that now has created a huge fund available for a rainy day. I'd hope they'd use it for alternate energy, but in any case, it's there because it's been taken out of the land.
Now, the film Matewan was based on that whole event in West Virginia. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a story which was enormous. The guards there came in, and they wanted to. There were protesters about the union. The people wanted to join the union, and then the guards came in and tried to stop the union from going in and created a war. And the sheriff of the town, named Hatfield, decided to side by the with the miners. And there was a shootout, and there was a bunch killed. But interesting story about Matewan. It was made into a movie, and it's a very poignant story. There is only two blocks of Matewan. It's a very small little community, and it sits at the bottom of the Tug Fork Juncture River. And every 11 years, it floods, and it floods the whole town. Two blocks. Byrd decided to protect that town, built a $68 million wall around it through government funds for two blocks. They should have moved the whole village. But in any case, I said, maybe it's right retribution that these projects were done. Maybe it's a gift back to the people of West Virginia because of what they gave in the original and were never credited for. So there might have been some balance. But when you see these projects, you see a Route 119, which goes to nowhere and went right through mountains. Mountains were torn down and the valleys were filled with the extra from the mountain. Extremely expensive projects that do not really have material value.
The proverbial road to nowhere.
That is the road to nowhere. It ends on the Kentucky line, and there's nothing there.
Amazing.
Truly amazing.
Some of the pictures in this book on West Virginia are almost like shots out of a time capsule, like an Esso filling station. We haven't had Esso for, 30 years, 40 years or something? I mean, it's Exxon now. There's a lot of that.
Yes, there is a little bit of a time warp, and people have kept to their traditions and have kept to their roots. That particular one in Kingman is a very, very beautiful reminiscent of what went on in West Virginia. You see this quite often.
Lucian Niemeyer, what are you working on now? You've done so many books. We've had you on the air many times talking about New Mexico wetlands and flowers and Africa and so on. What are your next projects?
I have a new book I'm working on. It's called First Nation Pueblo Portraits. It's a powerful story for me, too, because we haven't given credence to the Native American cultures as much as we should. In Canada, they determine all of the Native American cultures as First Nation, the First Nation of this country. And I'd like to start that process here with this book. And I tell some portraits, I show some portraits of the different pueblos here, whether it be Jemez or whether it be different pueblos. Could be bread making, could be jewelry making, could be pottery, could be different things that they do. And I'm not trying to involve myself into their culture as much as I am telling their story in terms of what they do.
Is this a New Mexico-based book? Are you going all over the whole Southwest?
No, just New Mexico, just in the pueblos off the Rio Grande.
Now, you've got another book that's done but not yet published about Bali.
Yes, it's called Bali, God, Rice, and Art. And it tells the story of a people that live extremely well inside their religion, extremely happy, content, and happy. They have as rice, it's a very, very laborious and a very difficult livelihood. And then they create some of the most beautiful art in the world. And it's a very, very important story, too, because what's happening, their success is causing the problem other demise, and it's happening very quickly.
What does that look like there?
It's beautiful.
But I mean, what's the nature of the success causing the demise?
What's happening is that people that live in Java, who are Muslim, come to Bali to gain an economic. They don't have that standard in Java, so they come to, because the economics are much better in Bali, and they're buying the Bali businesses because they save all their money for the businesses. And the Balinese spend almost all their money for the religious ceremonies. So the imbalance of these two things, it creates a problem that's going to happen.
And what's so ironic about that is the Balinese, and probably a few people have heard me talking about Bali on this show before because I had the great privilege to go there a couple of years ago. The Balinese religious ceremonies are so much a part of their daily life and culture. There's so much ceremony, and there's so much, and it has also kind of morphed into not only their own ceremonies, but what the tourists expect when they go there. And so it's a tremendous source of revenue. And yet, because they spend so much of their own income on that, it's not going back into their businesses.
No, and that's going to be the problem. It's a subtle thing, but the Balinese see it. They talk about it. They have a problem. They have no way to stop it. And what's going to happen, there's just not going to be the money to support the thousands of temples and the thousands of ceremonies. It's a beautiful culture, and we need to recognize and understand why it is so beautiful.
And we will have you on when the next book comes out. Photographer Lucian Niemeyer, thank you so much for being with us. And people can go visit with Lucian Niemeyer tomorrow night and hear him talk about his new book, The Art of Flower Photography, which we talked about in the first part of the show, and also the West Virginia book, West Virginia Mountain Air. And probably some of your other books will be there at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Friday, April 29th at 6 o'clock. So, and the website is lnsart.com. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Catherine.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.